Good morning. And welcome to a new series. Welcome back for those who were away for the winter. Pesach feels like it was so long ago at this point. I hope your Yom HaAtzmaut was beautiful and inspiring. And we have 4 weeks to talk about Jewish love. Rebranded. Originally I branded it marriage, and then I thought better of it. And it's a new age.
Yes.
So, yeah, we have our work cut out for us, certainly, and I'm glad so many people are here. I'm looking forward to a good discussion. I'm going to try to balance, you know, text and discussion to the extent I can. As always, if we don't get to everybody's comments, questions during the class, I am glad to continue by email afterwards. Please do. For those who haven't been here before, I record audio of the classes and I post it online, and I generally send out an email later in the day, both following up on items from the class and giving you the link where you can find the audio recording online. So if you have to miss a week, you should still be able to keep up. Of course, if you're on the audio, you can't really participate in the discussion. You can yell at your computer, but it's the same as yelling at your television. It doesn't really, you know, get you anywhere. If people could please silence their cell phones, that would be great. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to tackle this topic. I knew I wanted to talk about the topic, but there are so many different ways that you can do this. And what I ended up with was the idea of starting with the concept of love and relationships in Judaism in general, and then working from there towards, so what does that say about what people are supposed to look for in a spouse? And then from that into marriage, and then into what happens when it's not working out, the divorce side of things. And then, as I put on the flyer the last week, for same-gender attraction. So hopefully this will all hold together as a set of ideas, even though if you can't make it for a particular week, each week should really stand on its own. And I wanted to start with a passage that I actually just read last week, and it struck me as, I don't know, strange, funny, not quite what I would have expected. It's from a book called Yeled Shashu. If anyone doesn't have sheets, just leave these over there, because that would be helpful. Thank you. This is a new book. Yeled Shashuim is a new book. It's meant to be a sort of biography of a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Aharon Soloveitchik. If you've heard people quote Rav Soloveitchik, generally that's Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik. This is his brother, Rabbi Aharon Soloveitchik, who was a great teacher in his own right, based in New York, based in Chicago at one point. And in the problem, frankly, with the biography is that parts of it are not so well edited, so it doesn't read so smoothly. But I think the passage that I brought here works. It's describing how he and his wife were set up, and we'll talk about arranged marriages as part of this discussion as well. We're going to have a lot of fun. So if you look at the paragraph, it's the opening paragraph on the sheet, and it says, at the time that Ella Shurun met Harav Aharon, meaning Rabbi Aharon Soloveitchik, there was a suggestion of a shidduch for her with a wealthy, observant diamond merchant. Okay, a shidduch, hopefully that word is familiar to people, to be set up. And in those days, a wealthy, observant person was a rarity. But Rebbetzin Rus Shurun, mother of Ella Shurun, answered, Ella wants to marry specifically a torn coat. The original passage actually had the Yiddish with it, and I think it had more resonance in the Yiddish. Saying you want to marry a torn coat doesn't sound quite as good as in the Yiddish, but I didn't include the Yiddish, because it was actually in the Hebrew letters of the Yiddish, and writing those over, bless you, in English letters, writing Yiddish in English letters is painful. So I just left it. But Ella wants to marry specifically a torn coat. And then the person editorializes, the person writing the story, says, this is a shining example of what marriage is. A covenant of love. Marriage is not a business deal. Marriage is not a kavod enterprise. Kavod means honor, right. It's not the pursuit of honor, like I'm going to marry somebody who has great lineage and great standing, and therefore I will have honor as well. Marriage is a covenant of love that is inspired by faith and reaches into eternity.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's very poetic, isn't that great? Well, this is written now. It was published a couple of months ago. The story when they met?
Yeah.
Oh, so that would have to be 1930s, I believe. Yeah. So I don't remember it. I would have to look it up. I tell you what, that would be part of my homework. I'll send out the torn coat Yiddish. There is a mandel. Okay, you got it. See, my problem is that my grandparents were from Western Europe, so when my parents didn't want us to understand, they spoke French, not Yiddish. So I learned from French, but I didn't pick up the Yiddish. Yeah, I picked up about as much French as kids pick up in Ontario schools. Okay, anyway, point being that the claim is made that marriage is not about money and marriage is not about honor. Marriage is about love. So my question to you is, with your knowledge of Judaism and what Jews do, is this really what Judaism presents? Is that what marriage is about in Judaism? No. So Zena says no.
No.
Okay. Anybody want to say yes? Because then we can have an argument.
Ideally.
Yeah.
Ideally.
Ideally?
That sounds really good to me.
It sounds good.
Except that in older days, people were fixed up. They barely knew the person when they got married. So mm-hmm. How could you say that it was a covenant of love when half the time they had seen each other once?
So that's a very good question.
They fell in love later.
Right.
If it happens at all.
Right. So we're going to have to talk about how historical Fiddler on the Roof is or isn't. Meaning, no, I'm being serious. Because you have this in Fiddler on the Roof, the challenge of the arranged marriage versus the love marriage. That's exactly the question. Was that really what Jews did? And yes, it still happens in some communities today to a greater or lesser extent. But one of the things we have to discuss is, what was the original Jewish practice? Was it in fact arranged marriage? Did they see each other once? When do these different things begin? And to do that, we're really going to have to go back to biblical times. Meaning, it's not fair for me to look at 100 years ago or 200 years ago and say, well, that's what Judaism is. Let's go back to the beginning. Dina.
It was about Yichus. Mm-hmm. It was about this rabbinical family married into that rabbinical family.
So Dina suggests that it was about yichus. Yichus is a funny word. People usually render yichus as prestige, but what it actually means is association. It means to be associated with someone. So that it comes to be used in terms of marriage, usually regarding lineage, your family. Somebody from a good family has yichus. That's the way that it's usually described. But we're going to have to talk about the arranged marriage and what it does to the idea of love, and the question of, really, what is Judaism's version of what relationships are supposed to be about? Where does love fit in? Side question that's going to be very relevant for us in the secular world, in general society. When did love, romantic love, become a concept, become a goal?
Renaissance. When women ceased to become chattel.
I wasn't aware that had happened yet.
Your wife didn't hear that. Your wife is
delicious. Yeah, I'm on record. So when women ceased to be chattel.
In Western society.
Okay. Any other suggestions? Historians, many of them, put it at the 11th century.
Which one?
Late 11th century France, as put forth by various writers. We're going to get to some of it, actually, in a bit. But what I'd like to do to start examining this topic in a serious way is to go, as I wrote on your sheet, back to the beginning. Back to the beginning means the beginning. Adam and Eve. Bereshit to Genesis chapter 1. And I brought you a translation first of a brief passage from the first chapter. This is the creation of human beings. We're familiar with how the story works, right? Day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5. Day 6, creation of the animals, and then creation of human beings. And God said in source number 2, "Let us make man in the image and form." I brought you the Hebrew terms, Tselem and Dmut, we have designed, right? God uses the plural to describe God, whether that means because God is the sum of all powers, whether it's the royal we, however you want to read that, but it's, he uses the we. He says, let us make man in the image and form we have designed, and he will rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and the beasts in the entire land, and all of the crawling creatures that crawl upon the land. And God created man in his image. In the image created by God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. The reason why I note that it's according to Rashi's commentary is because there's one phrase that always is very difficult to translate. God says, let us make man in our image, is the way it's often translated. Right? Na'aseh Adam b'tzalemeinu, which can be translated as in our image. The problem is that many leading thinkers within Judaism, Maimonides very strongly among them, said God doesn't have an image. There's no such thing as a body for God. If God had a physical form, he could deteriorate, he could fall apart. So it must be that God doesn't have an image. Well, in that case, how can he say in our image? And so the way various commentators have rendered it, going back to Rashi as one classic source, is it doesn't mean, but Salomeinu doesn't mean in our image, as in what I look like. But it means in the image that I have created, the image that I have set up for human beings. That's the way I translated here. Not so relevant for us. What is relevant for us is who is created in this decree in source number 2. Who does God create here?
Male and female.
Male and female. Does this fit the story you're familiar with for how Adam and Eve are created?
No.
No. What's the story? How did Eve come into this world? A rib. We'll talk about the rib. We're not there yet, but shortly. Stephen, come join me. Someone else with a Y chromosome, please. So right now, all we see here, male and female, God created them. As far as I can tell from reading this, we are created simultaneously. But then take a look at source number 3.
May I ask?
Yeah, please.
Was the first woman Lilith?
No. 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 What happens with the Lilith story is the fact that the text here we just saw in source number 2 says male and female, he created them. And then what's going to sound like is another creation story. And so what you have are people who have said, well, maybe the first one is one woman and then the next one is another woman. But it doesn't appear. You will not find Lilith anywhere in the Bible. You will not find Lilith anywhere in early Midrash. You will not find Lilith anywhere in the Talmud. It's a late idea that people grabbed onto because, wow, doesn't that sound cool? A woman who wouldn't listen to her husband in the beginning and then got punished for it. It's the sort of idea that captures our attention. But you'll be looking forever if you're looking in the original texts for it. It's a neat story. So our first version of this, male and female are created in God's image. Then take a look at source number 3, which is from the next chapter. And God formed the man, dirt from the ground, and he breathed into his nostrils the spirit of life, and the man was a living spirit. And then we get a nice long passage there about God creating the Garden of Eden. And then God says, you know, human beings need company. And God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. I shall make him a help opposite him. In Hebrew, the term is azer. Lazor is to help. And God formed from the earth all beasts of the field and all birds of the heavens, and he brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And all that man named it, every living creature, was its name. And the man named every animal and bird of the heavens, every beast of the field, I hope not each one individually, just the species. But for the man he did not find a help opposite him. And God settled a deep sleep upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his sides and sealed the flesh beneath it. I translate it as sides. The word in Hebrew is tsela. That's the term. Achat mitzal otav. Tsela in Hebrew, tzadi lamed ayin. So the word tsela is used in the biblical text in the Chumash to mean the side of something. For example, the Jews had a traveling temple that they used when they were in the wilderness on their way from Egypt into Israel. It was called a Mishkan, right. It's a Mishkan. And when the text describes the construction of the Mishkan, it talks about how they made the walls surrounding it out of boards. And each side, as it describes how many boards to use on each side, it says, Sela HaMishkan. The word Sela means side. It does not necessarily mean rib. And for reasons that we'll get to, I think side is a better translation in this particular context, not rib. But he took one of his sides and sealed the flesh beneath it. And God built the side he had taken from the man into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And the man said, "This time, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, this shall be called Isha, for she was taken from Ish." I left it using the Hebrew words because that's the play on words. Ish is the word for the male, and then Isha, something that is almost the same, but a little bit different, since you know there's different genders, is going to be the term for her. And then the text concludes, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and stick to his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Okay, what are the differences between these two accounts, other than the obvious that in the first account, men and women are created separately, at the same time, and in the second account, it's man, he's lonely. Dog is apparently man's best friend, but that's not good enough. Okay, fine. Let's create a wife instead. What are the other differences between the two accounts?
Where does the parents come from?
Parents?
Yeah.
There are none.
Yeah.
There are no parents in either one. Not in the first one and not in the second one. Thanks.
We leave the father and mother.
Sorry?
Father and mother.
Oh, you mean, well, no, this is a statement for the future. In other words, God set it up for this couple, and then going forward, they should always continue in this vein, that they should find a mate. That's the idea. Now, at this point, leaving the father and mother is much easier. Also, there's no mention of who's paying for the wedding. This is much more straightforward. No fights over whether they're going to walk down with candles, without candles. You know, none of that. It's straightforward. There isn't even a videographer. Can you imagine?
Yes. So, the account before this is that Hashem created all the creatures, etc., etc. So why did he have to create, is there any talk about why he had to create the woman or the female from the man as opposed to creating the female the way he created the man?
Well, absolutely. You have to wonder why is she being created from him in the second account, and in the first account it doesn't sound like that at all. What's the advantage of taking her from him? So one of the suggestions that's made is that this will actually create a greater affinity between them. In other words, she's not a separate being who's now being brought to him, but actually they're from.
Okay, so like
the same.
Our concept now of cloning. I'm using that loosely, but like making it so similar. You're saying as opposed to.
Right. So that's one way to look at it. There's going to be another way to look at it, though, that I'm going to bring shortly, which I think casts it in a bit of a different light. But there's another major difference here.
She's the last beast.
Yes. Well, she is the last beast, right? She's the last one to be created. It's a very interesting passage in the Talmud, in Sanhedrin, in which they say putting human beings at the end of creation accomplishes two different messages, two opposite messages. On the one hand, if we are arrogant, then God can say, you know, the mosquitoes came before you. On the other hand, if we don't recognize our value as human beings, God says, well, I set everything up for you and then brought you in at the end, you're the most important. In which case, Eve, Chava, ends up being the most important because she's the one who comes in last, not to mention, as we all know, the chance to correct all the mistakes from the first model, right? Eve is human 2.0. But I think there's another major difference here. In the first version of this, right? In the first version that we see, in the first version that we see here, human beings are created in God's image. That's it. We just come into the world in God's image. In the second version, look at the beginning of source number 3. God forms the body and then separately puts the soul into it. Material first. And then the soul is added to it. I think that's another very interesting distinction. There are other distinctions of language. If you were to look at it in the Hebrew, the verbs that are used in the two different ones are different. For those who know Hebrew, the first version of it uses the verb livro, which is usually used to create like something from nothing, the commentators understand. Whereas in the second one, I noted it with the English translation, it says, and God formed Vayitzer. It's like you're taking material that's there and then shaping it. There are all sorts of differences in the language of the first and the second. So how do you account for these differences in the stories? So if I wasn't a believer in the holy character of the text, I would just say that there were different creation myths that people had in that region at that time, and the editor of this work decided, rather than alienate anybody, I'll just include both stories. Which, to me, is not a very satisfying explanation, because by including both stories, you satisfy no one, not everyone. Right? If I include everybody's stories, I include the version of these people, I include the version of these people, I'm not so sure anybody's walking away happy. I think that the way to understand this is actually that there are lessons being taught by each version. And we've talked about this actually in different classes a little bit. For example, there's one approach, Nachmanides in the 13th century suggests that the first account is the creation of the soul, and the second account is the creation of the body. We talked about this. The idea that, and it's reflected in passages in the Talmud, and this is going to go back to the question from before about the value of creating her from his body. There's a passage in the Talmud that actually argues that Adam and Eve are created back to back in one body at first, and they just face different directions, but they're able to communicate with each other. Procreation is going to be managed, and that's the way they're supposed to go forward in the world. The problem is it doesn't work very well. There's a certain sense of satisfaction that a human being has when another human being chooses to be with them. If you're one body, and that's it, and this is your mate, and that's the way you're designed, you lose that sense of volition, that sense of choice. And so God says, you know what, this isn't good, this system of having them be one. Instead of reading that line as, it's not good for them to be alone, the word in Hebrew is levado, it's not good for them to be one. I'm going to make them opposite each other. If you remember the wording, a help opposite, and then they can choose to be together, and psychologically that will actually work better for them. And so God separates Eve from Adam's body because they were one body, and now they're separated. And that's one idea. There's a lot of discussion about this, but here's the approach I want to take to this, and I think it's going to shape everything that we talk about here in discussing love and relationships. In the first chapter, yeah, Nancy. Yes.
Is this the same sort of deep sleep that settled upon Abraham and the covenant?
That is a really good question. The answer is yes. It's the same word in Hebrew, tardema. So I believe the word tardema, the word tardema is used here. And if I remember correctly, the same word applies to Abraham and that covenant between the pieces. Yes. Correct. I don't know what to do with that association, but yes.
We're presently studying.
Ah, well, she will be able to answer you. She'll tell you. Okay. So, in the first chapter, the way that it's presented, human beings are part of the overall structure of creation. And I was going to bring it on the sheet, but it would have taken forever, and then we wouldn't have gotten anywhere beyond it. So I didn't bring it for you. But if you open up a Chumash, if you open up the biblical text, you will see that human beings are described as part of the hierarchy of plant and fish and bird and animal. We're part of that kingdom. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Yosef Soloveitchik, the one who is not in the biography in source number one, he wrote about this in a book called The Emergence of Ethical Man. And what he said is that the language that the biblical text uses to describe the creation of human beings is the same as what it uses for the animals. So, for example, we emerge from the earth. That's what it says for the animals also. It's what it says for the plants also. They come out of the ground. Adam himself, the name Adam, where does it come from?
Adama,
which means earth. It's the creation of human beings from the ground. The verbs that are used for creation for human beings in chapter 1, are the same that are used for the creation of all the other creatures. There are some signs of potential differentiation in chapter 1. They're not entirely the same. So there are elements of difference. Take a look at source number 4. God speaks of the sea creatures in that first verse that I bring you, and God blessed them, the creatures of the sea, saying, bear fruit and multiply and fill the water in the seas, and the birds shall multiply on land. Right? The Hebrew for bear fruit and multiply, pru uravu, produce fruit, a pri, uravu, become harbe, you shall multiply. And then the second line there is from human beings on day 6, and God blessed them, the humans, and God said to them, bear fruit and multiply and fill the land and control it. There are distinctions, right? Control it, you know, jumps out at us. And there's another difference. What's the other difference besides controlling? Between what God says for the sea creatures and what God says for the people. Very interesting difference. Sorry? To fill the land. Well, they're filling the water, we're filling the land. That's generally a good idea, that kind of division of responsibility.
It says the human should control their offspring.
Well, that doesn't say control the offspring. Good luck. But there's something else.
Let's control their people.
That wasn't in the manual.
And God said to them.
Good. Janice points out that when God speaks of the sea creatures multiplying, he doesn't communicate with them. With human beings, he blesses us and speaks to us. So that's a very important point that we're going to have to come back to. Take a look in source number 5. God assigns human beings their diet. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth. To you it shall be for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. So first of all, what's the similarity between people and animals? We're all vegetarian at that stage, right? Human beings are not allowed to eat meat until after the flood, right? We talked about this in some other class at some other point. But we're all vegetarian at that initial stage. However, there's one difference between the way God assigns the diets to human beings and the way God assigns it to the animals and birds and so on. What's the difference?
Well, the animals only have three herbs. So everybody else has
it. Oh, because I translated one. Well, it's true. Right, Yerek, Yerek versus Asa.
It seems to be limiting it somewhere.
I hear that. I hear that. But also, yeah, Joan was going to say.
I have given.
He says I have given in both, but in the first one, God speaks to us. Just like with the blessing of reproduction, right? For sea creatures, God says, I'm going to bless them that they should do it. He doesn't address them. With human beings, he addresses us and says, bear fruit and multiply. When it comes to the food also, God just says, here's the food for the animals. For the human beings, he says, I am giving it to this communication. And most powerfully, the words that we used before, we said creating human beings in the image designed by God with this tselem, source number 6, Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, Tselem signifies man's awareness of himself as a biological being, the state of being informed of his natural drives. Self-awareness is what human beings get versus what the animals get. So these are some differences. The similarities are many. The language that's used, created from the ground, created the same style, given the same diet, given the same you should go forth and reproduce. All those things are the same. Only difference so far is communication from God. But then take a look at source number 7. Because that's really the key difference. In chapter 2, and God commanded upon the man, saying, from every tree in the garden you shall eat. And of course you know the rest of the line and the rest is history. Right? Every tree in the garden you shall eat. Just not the one I put in the middle. That looks really good. That one. Not all the others. And of course, make a beeline to that tree. But that's the key. The creatures God creates first, birds, fish, animals, don't get commanded anything. There is no instruction. to human being, God gives an instruction. Or take a look at number 8, the way Rabbi Soloveitchik worded it. God takes man-animal, because that's what we are until then, into his confidence, addresses him, and reveals to him his moral will. He says, this is what I want you to do. But that happens in the second chapter, not the first. So in other words, the first chapter emphasizes that which we have in common with the plant and animal kingdoms, while the second chapter emphasizes our standing as moral, ethical beings who can have an instruction and who can decide not to follow our instincts, but instead to do what we believe is appropriate to do. Right? Ethics fundamentally are the calculation of appropriateness, to decide what is right for a situation instead of what I want in that situation. That only comes in chapter 2. Why is Torchina bothering us with chapter 1 and chapter 2? Because didn't we just say in sources 2 and 3 that chapter 1 has male and female created together? Chapter 2 has male and female created separately. Chapter 1 is the one where we are like the animals. We're like everything else in creation. Everything is created with both genders. We don't find a story with fish in which God creates the male fish and then separates out the female fish from the male fish. They're all created with whatever genders they need. Whereas when it comes to human beings, we have one account of being created like the animals, with male and female together, and then we have this other account which separates us. So here's my question. What does this say about the reason why human beings are separated out and need to find a mate rather than be born with a built-in one? What does this say about, I'm going to use terms now that saying animal man sounds weird, but that's the term I'm going to use because it fits. What does animal man want in a mate versus what spiritual man wants in a mate? And again, man doesn't mean male. Man means humanity. So maybe I should just say woman and be done with it, given that I'm the distinct minority here. What does animal woman want in a mate, and what does human woman want in a mate? Yes?
I think the difference is freedom of choice. Animal doesn't have freedom of choice.
Animal doesn't. Right.
They're hungry, they eat.
Right.
The difference is between men.
So with the animal, it's instinct rather than selection. Okay. Yes, Linda.
To help him make the choice, to help man be woman animal, is to help man animal make the moral choice.
To help make the moral choice. And having the mate is to help you be a moral person. Okay. Doesn't work because doesn't happen.
And otherwise, you know, people wouldn't cheat, and people with respect to love and marriage, and because we don't always make the right choice.
This is also true. But it may be a goal anyway.
Okay.
It could be a goal. We'd like to.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to it, actually, because I think there's more to say on that point.
Part of the purpose we talked about earlier on in one of these examples is to have the perfect partner. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficult thing, what you're saying about the flaws and everything, but the objective is to have, or at least a really good partner.
Right.
The right, you know how we always say the right partners end up together? We often use that terminology. Something of that concept.
Okay.
Because the original purpose, we said, was to have help. Like to... Right. Assist each other through.
Okay. Sylvia, and then?
In simple terms, I think the Torah is all about God created the animals and God created the humans. We should behave better than the animals.
Why? Why does that follow? I happen to think we should. I'm not disagreeing with the concept. But
because we are elevated. We should elevate ourselves to higher...
But God created the animals also. But he created the animals too. Why can't they elevate themselves? One second. Yeah. So that's an interesting question. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, do you and your comment you made regarding the creation of man along with all the animals?
Yeah.
Could there be some connection to the evolutionary process of human evolution? But thereafter, consciousness, awareness, ethics,
Yeah.
Evolutionary.
So.
This along with the evolution of the consciousness, the spirit, the.
Right. So the question of whether to map evolution onto it is that it's a difficult thing to map directly, in the sense that our order is wrong in the text if we were really to read this as an evolutionary order, meaning the fish lead to, how does it work? Is it fish leading to birds to animals? Or fish? No, birds lead to fish to animals. The order doesn't quite fit, and they're described as discrete constructs. However, having said that, there are those who absolutely read that into the text. And Rav Soloveitchik, in his work, in The Emergence of Ethical Man, says we have to be careful not to be convinced by the way Christians look at the Bible, into assuming that their read is our read. Their read is not our read. And there are things which they are very horrified by, like the idea of evolution, which Judaism can be a lot more comfortable with. That was the course that we had in the winter when we talked about science and Torah. We have to make sure that the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, for that matter, don't shape our view of what the text is telling us. That comes through in many ways. I'm going to make the following suggestion, though. These are all, I think, important points. Whether we're talking about the moral purpose of marriage, whether we're talking about procreation, whatever instinct versus selection, all of these, I think, are important points. But I think one way to look at it is that in chapter 1, the animal side, fundamentally, the language of chapter 1 is procreation. That's what it's all about. Each species is created to reproduce according to its own kind. That's stressed repeatedly within the text. Each species is told, or each kingdom is told, pru urvu, bear fruit, and become many. The focus in chapter 1 is procreation. The plants and the animals have it as a key element in their created identity. We already saw it in the text for the... We saw it in the text for the sea creatures. It also appears in the text for the plants. I just didn't bring it. It's interesting. The only one who is not told to bear fruit and multiply are the beasts of the field. Rashi commenting there says it's because God doesn't want to bless the snake to bear fruit and multiply, because it's going to get into trouble. There are other answers, but I thought that was a very interesting answer. But the emphasis is on the need of the species to reproduce. That's what it's about. So that it's the sexual drive. It's the appeal of the mate who's going to maximize procreation through traits that signify this is a good mate. This is the one who, whatever reason, physically, financially, whatever, is going to be a good mate for my children. That's your chapter 1. That's the animal side of why you would look to have a relationship, and it has nothing to do with romantic love, for sure. It has nothing to do with higher values and make me a better person. It's simply, we want to be able to continue the human race. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, though, with the start of God not only addressing human beings, but instructing human beings, saying, there are things that you need to do, or that you should do, even though they go against your instincts. That introduces for human beings the capacity for ethical, appropriate action instead of self-serving instinct. And there the emphasis, go back to it in source number 3, is to find a help opposite him. It's not simply, I'm creating a species, male and female are going to be there, they're going to mate, and therefore the species will continue to exist. Rather, it's, they need a help opposite them. There's a spiritual need for a partner. What does a help opposite mean? Because that's actually a funny turn of phrase. You would think a help would be alongside, not opposite. So take a look at source number 9. Rashi, the classic commentator in 11th century France, says, he's basing his comment on a passage from the Talmud, making it 1,000 years older than he is. He says, you know why? Azer kenegdo, a help opposite him, are actually two different terms describing two different types of relationship. If he merits, she will be a help. If he does not merit, she will be opposite him, fighting him. By the way, you can flip the genders on that one also. Okay? Don't get too, self-satisfied here. But it depends. If you do a good job, then the person's going to be your help. Otherwise, it's going to be the opposite. And that's one approach. Another approach, Nachmanides, who I mentioned before, said that we were initially two souls in one body, and then we were separated out in source number 10. So he said that's exactly what this is saying. Perhaps one could say this is like the Talmudic statement. They were formed as two images in one body. God saw that it would be good for the support to stand apart from him, visible to him, separate from him, and they could join willingly. Thus, I will make a help opposite him. Opposite doesn't mean against, but it means literally standing apart, and then they can choose to join. But either way, whichever take you have, the point is, there is a much stronger spiritual sense in the second version. And so when we ask the question of how is it that Jews are supposed to look at relationships and ultimately at joining together with someone in marriage, we say, well, there are two levels of need. There's the animal and there's the spiritual. And both of them are legitimate. You can't downplay one in the name of the other. So there is the aspect of, I need somebody who is going to be a good mate in terms of continuity of the human race, somebody who is going to check all the boxes in terms of what it is that tells me this person is going to be a good producer of children, which on a very animal level generally comes down to how well can they fend for themselves economically, how well can they fend for themselves physically. That's really what it, and I guess also in terms of the mother, it will also involve how well do they appear physically suited to be able to birth and produce children. And then from the spiritual side, it's going to be, will this person be a help to me in terms of fulfilling my spiritual identity? That's what you get on the second side. Janice.
I was wondering, I guess I have a good marriage because we've talked about Ezra could take no for years, and it's been troublesome for me. But my husband says that it was explained to him as a young man in Israel that Ezra could go works like a pair of scissors. It's opposite.
Yeah.
If you do it wrong, it doesn't work. But it's the help. It only works if you work it together. As you said, it doesn't work against. It's not against. It's opposite.
I like the image.
You like the image?
Yeah. I like that image.
He's the one who told me. He's the
okay.
The scissor image.
Okay.
Him,
I like
means
that.
Ezra Kazedo. Not as a negative person.
Okay. Unless the blade is really sharp. And then you
can...
Okay. So, all of what we've said, though, until now, has talked about filling needs, right? Whether it is my need to procreate, or whether it is my need to have somebody who is going to help me grow spiritually, fundamentally, that's not pure love, right? That's not what love is, and so we have to ask the question, where does love fit into this? Is there such a thing as love in Judaism? Well, we have a word for love, don't we? What's the word in Hebrew for love?
Ahava.
What does that mean, though? What does ahava really mean? Beyond saying, translating it as the word love, what sort of love is included when you say somebody is ohave somebody else?
To like?
To give? That's interesting. We're going to come back to that one. Oh, you can tell me now, Sylvia. Go ahead.
We usually think of what we can get out of the relationship or what's up, but really, love is what you can give somebody without asking.
That's remind me of that when we get down to number 15, because that's actually where I want to bring that idea in, and I'll tell you something about the word ahava that's associated with that. So we have like, we have give. The truth of the matter is that the word ahava is a catch-all word for all manner of close affection. It's not really, certainly not romantic love. It's not pure love. It tends to refer to strong affection, strong positive affection, I should say. But that's really it. It refers to relationships between people. It also refers to relationships between human beings and God. Right? How do you know that? How do you, where do we see the, yeah? Right. The Ahavta et Hashem Elokecha in Shema, right? You shall love Hashem your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your resources. Correct. The not only that, when you look in Tanakh, when you look at biblical text, love can refer to love of money. Love can refer to love of evil. It isn't even about human beings. It's strong emotion about something. And not only that, when it refers to relationships, it's not specifically pure. I brought you one example. Source number 11, the story of Dinah. And Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, leader of the land, saw Dinah, and he took her, and he lay with her, and he oppressed her. And his soul stuck to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl. That's not what we're thinking of when we say love. So the word ahava is not really a good word for this. And in fact, as I said at the outset, there are those who contend that there's a good reason for it. That the concept of pure love comes in late in the game. In the 11th century. Source number 12, C.S. Lewis. Right, when he wasn't writing Narnia. So he has an essay called Courtly Love, which is published in a book called The Anatomy of Love, in which he makes the following remarkable claim. I have to admit, I'm not a regular reader of The Anatomy of Love. However, Rabbi Dr. Maurice Lamb wrote a work, which is a classic, called The Jewish Way in Love and Marriage. And he quoted this source as well as what you're going to see in number 13. He says, in ancient literature, this is C.S. Lewis writing, in ancient literature, love seldom rises above the levels of merry sensuality or domestic comfort. Love is either about the sensual or it's about comfort. We do well together. Except to be treated as a tragic madness which plunges otherwise sane people, usually women, into crime and disgrace. Sorry. Such is the love of Medea, Phaedra, Dido, I don't know if it's Dido or not, and such the love from which maidens pray that the gods may protect them. At the other end of the scale, we find the comfort and utility of a good wife acknowledged. Odysseus loves Penelope as he loves the rest of his home and possessions. And Aristotle rather grudgingly admits that the conjugal relation may now and then rise to the same level as the virtuous friendship between good men. I'm going to come back to that because I don't think he's fair to Aristotle. But this has plainly very little to do with love in the modern or medieval sense. And if we turn to ancient love poetry proper, we shall be even more disappointed. We shall find the poets loud in their praises of love, no doubt. What is love? Life without love? Tra-la-la. I don't know that song. As the later song has it. But this is no more to be taken seriously than the countless panegyrics, both ancient and modern, on the all-consoling virtues of the bottle. You love your spouse the way you love to drink. That's C.S. Lewis, a very cynical take. Kind of surprising, actually. But he believes that until you get to the 11th century, love is either something sexual, or love is the comfort of having a spouse you can rely on. Right? The one spouse is going to earn a living, the other spouse is going to prepare dinner. I am not going to say which spouse is going to do which. But that's the way that it was, he says, until a relatively modern period. Take a look at number 13, in which a writer by the name of Denis de Rougemont, I think that's how it's pronounced, he lived in Switzerland, he wrote in French, says the following about the way people look for a spouse today and trying to find love as the means of picking who you're going to marry. We are in the act of trying out and failing miserably at it, one of the most pathological experiments that a civilized society has ever imagined. Namely, the basing of marriage which is lasting upon romance, which is a passing fancy. Of all the possible motives for the marriage act enumerated above, which he gave before the part I excerpted, we are, practically speaking, embracing only the most unstable and ephemeral. No one will deny for a minute that in a healthy social order, love and romance must play a certain role, but in this case it should play the minor and final role of a catalyst, which can disappear with no damage ensuing once the combination has worked by virtue of its presence. He says, love is good in order to make people come together for the other things that they can in the end have. And that way, once you're already safely married, and you're gaining the benefits of married life, it doesn't matter if love disappears because you have all the other niceties of the relationship. Also, a little bit too cynical for me. But according to this view, that's, you know, the idea of romantic love and the emphasis on it is a modern thing. In which case, all of the times, and there are so many, in which the biblical text speaks of love in a relationship, I can't read it as pure love. Right? In Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, the beloved calls out and says, Cholat Ahava Ani, I am sick with love, which I would like to read as I'm enthralled with the other. That is just, you know, this person, although in that case it's a human being in God, but the other is such a wonderful person, such an admirable person, such a beautiful soul, that I am just sick with love for them. But according to C.S. Lewis, that's not actually what the text is saying. It's infatuation with physical attributes. It's the desire to be married and to be in a stable relationship. You follow? So are they right? Are Lewis and the Rougemont, are they correct? Rabbi Lamb seems to think they are correct. I'm not with him on this. I think those who post-date pure love are mistaken, both in terms of general thought and in terms of Jewish thought. Take a look at number 14, please. This is a passage from Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot is something that is put together over a period of generations. Going back to the Second Temple period, so you're talking 2,200 years ago, 2,300 years ago, as a start, and then working its way forward until about 1,900 years ago. The sages who are in it are clearly long before the 11th century. And here's a passage which, to me, answers the question. Any love which depends on something, when the thing ceases, the love ceases. In Hebrew, ahava hatluya b'davar. If love is dependent on a particular thing, then when the thing is gone, the love is gone. And that which does not depend on something will never cease. And they look for examples. What is love which depends on something? The love of Amnon for Tamar. It's a very crass example. Anyone know the story? What's the example of Amnon and Tamar? What's the story? Sorry? He rapes her. Yeah. They're half-siblings. And Amnon decides that he's in love with Tamar until he rapes her. And when this is over, he's no longer interested. So they're using that as an example of love which is dependent on something else. It's dependent on that infatuation that he has, that he wants to fill. It's grotesque. Love that does not depend on something. The love of David and Jonathan. What's that story? The love of David and Jonathan? It's not a sexual love. That's not what it's talking about. Sorry. It's friendship, but it's a particular friendship. It's a particular situation. David is coronated to be the king over Israel. There are certain things you don't do in the Middle East. One of them is naming the new leader while the previous leader is still alive. It's just a very bad idea. And that's what happens here. Saul is the king. David is coronated to replace Saul. Saul is not on the same page. He wants to kill David. Saul has a son whose name is Jonathan. And Jonathan, Yehonatan, is the best friend that David can have. He helps him to figure out whether Saul really wants to kill him. And when he finds out that's true, he helps him to flee. Even though he knows that by helping David, what is he doing to himself? He's losing the kingdom. He's turning against his own family. And he's fundamentally undermining himself. But that's his feeling for David. And that's the love that's being described here. The love that they share is not dependent on something at all. It's not about what I can gain. Just the opposite. It's costing him everything. But nonetheless, that's what he does. He acts it to help the other, and he's close with him. So that what you find here, long before the 11th century, is the statement of and the glorification of a love which is not about procreation, and a love which is not about what the other does for me, but something that is far more pure than that. The idea of it appears not only in Jewish sources, but it also appears in non-Jewish sources. There's a passage in Aristotle, which I think I was going to bring here, and I'm not sure why I didn't. It's not the one I brought in 15. 15 is a separate one. But there's a passage also in Pirkei Avot in which the text says you should try to acquire a friend for yourself, k'nei lecha chaver. And on that, Maimonides in his commentary quotes Aristotle to say there are three different kinds of friendship. There are friendships which are for profit, where there's some benefit that you can gain from the other. There's friendship that is respect. You respect the other. And then there's friendship that's just a pure friendship. And Maimonides doesn't say it himself. Aristotle said it. And that's why I think that C.S. Lewis is cheating Aristotle. I don't think that that he was so focused on a more mundane view of love. I think there is this idea. So now what we have is actually a third dimension. And I realize we're getting to the end, and that's bad because I have more sources I wanted to see. I'm not going to rush through 15 and 16. It wouldn't be good. But what I want to say is, so far, what I hope we've established in our time today, and then what it means is that we'll have to come back to the love and giving piece next time, because that's really tied into where we're going. But what we've seen is there are two accounts of the creation of human beings, this male and female in the biblical text. The first one is anchored in the animal nature of the human being, which must reproduce and which seeks a mate for that purpose. With that in mind, that's legitimate. The second chapter, human being as ethical human being. And that's a very different pursuit. You're looking for a mate who's going to help you grow spiritually to be the one who will do that which you're supposed to do, who's going to help you live up to the ethics that are expected of the human being, the spiritual human being. Those are the basics. However, there is an element of pure love recognized as well. We saw it in the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot, crediting it to David and Jonathan in the text, in Tanakh. There are other examples we could bring, but I felt that was a very strong example of it. Saying that, there is this other element as well. This element of pure love in addition. It's not necessarily, though, the foundation. It's a desirable ideal, which can exist and, despite what we saw in number 13, can even endure. But it's not there in the first two chapters of Genesis, of Bereshit. It's not one of the central drives. The central drives are the procreative and the spiritual. And then in addition, there's this love element as well. What I want to do next time is to talk about a little bit more about love as an ideal and how it develops within Jewish thought. Where does love come from? And then to turn to dating, discuss the issue of arranged marriages, discuss the concept of basheret. Right? What does basheret mean? Meant to be. It's been arranged. God already knows who I'm supposed to marry, and that's it. Well, then why am I bothering? Right? And why is it that so many marriages end in divorce? What happened there? What is this all about? What does basheret mean? And so what should Jewish dating look like? What is the expectation? And then to move from that into marriage. We have an awful lot to talk about. Hopefully we'll enjoy the ride. Thank you very much. If anyone